Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
So thanks to Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to co-present this evening, to the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and finally the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Here's Rick to introduce our special guest. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris, and thank you also very much. And I believe it was 8 years ago when We Should Never Meet was Amy Fahn's remarkable debut collection of stories was published. Tonight she's here with a remarkable and wonderful debut novel titled The Reeducation of Cherry Chuang, a novel that tells stories that really still are not well or widely told and known in this country. The stories, the linked stories of two families who came out of Vietnam and are both in the United States and in France. It's a wonderful novel, and I think tonight it'll be a pleasure to get to hear her read from and talk about it. So with that, thank you again for being here, and please join in welcoming Amy Fahn.
Thank you, Chris and Rick, and thank you to the Friends of the Seattle Public Library and Elliott Bay. And I was I taught at Washington State from 2005 to 2007, so it was 2 years. But in that 2 years, I read at the Seattle Public Library three times, which I thought was so cool. You don't get that at most public libraries, and so I've always really had a special place in my heart for the Seattle Public Library. So it was the Chinatown branch, Beacon Hill, and the main library. So thank you so much for that lovely introduction and for coming here to hear about the novel. Can you hear me? That's good. Okay, so Rick gave you a little bit of an introduction to this novel, and I'll tell you a little bit about how it came to be, and then I'll read three sections from it. So I had written a bunch of short stories when I first started writing about different Vietnamese characters and their families, and the stories felt a little bit isolated, and I realized after some time that these stories were actually comprised of characters who were related to each other. And once I knew that, I realized that I had a novel in my hands with differing multiple perspectives, and I loved that idea of exploring a bunch of different characters, family members, who all had something to say about the way they came over here. And with my own family, my dad has 9 sisters and 1 brother, and my father has my mother has 3 sisters and 4 brothers. And so lots of aunts and uncles, they all have their own children, and they all had a different way of getting to America or France. And what I thought was so interesting was that no one could ever tell the same story about it, even if they were on the same boat together. There was always a different story. And so I would see my family at dinners and at Christmas celebrations or at summer reunions and think, within that room, there are so many different stories and different past shared histories that they don't necessarily want to talk about, but will come up, erupt in different ways over the dinner table, and then they'll be suppressed. And so it was always interesting to me as a writer being able to explore those different characters. So a lot of the inspiration of the book is from my family, even though I assure my family members, they're not really you at all. So the narrator is Cherry Trung, and she is a young Vietnamese-American woman, and she's the only one of her family who was born in America. So she's already kind of separated from the rest of her family, and as a result of that, they don't always tell her things. And she's about to enter medical school and fulfill her family's dreams when she decides she wants to go back to Vietnam to find her brother. Her brother was exiled to Vietnam 5 years previously and then decided not to come back to America. And so this is a little bit about her trying to find out why he stayed away. And that sets off the mysteries of the novel. So this is from the prologue, from The Reeducation of Cherry Trunk. Aside from the afternoon tour of the housing project, Cherry has barely seen her brother. Lum's company is at a crucial stage in the project, days away from their grand unveiling to clients, and he can't afford to go sightseeing. He leaves her every morning at the house with Grand Aunt and Grand Uncle Tran. It's not so bad. She has a month. She likes exploring the house where her grandparents lived, sleeping in the bedroom that once belonged to her parents. Cherry's grandparents gave their house to the Trans before escaping the country. The tall, gray concrete house with creaky floors and paper-thin walls sits in a middle-class neighborhood surrounded by other homes just like it. The shady, winding street crackles with women, young and elderly, cooking outside their front doors, trucks and scooters rattling by, and children chasing each other in overlapping, endless games of tag. At night, Cherry listens to the thumps of the water pipes, constantly adjusting to the changes in pressure. She imagines one of them bursting, flooding the house, forcing them all out. Spending so much time with the Trans, Cherry understands why Lum hasn't bothered moving out. They are his ideal parents, compulsively doting upon him, preparing his meals and pressing his clothes, without ever questioning his comings or goings or scolding his table manners. Having lost two sons in the war, the youngest, Cherry's father's age, Lum's presence is more than enough to fill them with excited chatter at dinner time. After Grand Aunt prepares their breakfast, they walk around the neighborhoods, attempting to fulfill Cherry's request to see the city her parents once knew, before the Microsoft billboards and ubiquitous Kodak Photoshops. In the Cholon district, Grand Aunt points out the Trans old apartment and former friends' homes. They pass the food markets where her grandmare once frequented and have lunch in Grandpere's favorite garden. They visit the cemetery where the Trans sons are buried. Cherry never feels more American than when they are walking. She guiltily buffers herself between her much frailer relatives, who never seem nervous as they weave through the steady cross-flow of cars, motorbikes, and pedestrians, pulling Cherry through the city current. "They won't hit you," Grand Uncle tries to assure her, "if you go slow enough." "In America, we stop for pedestrians," Cherry says, eyeing a family of four sailing past on a scooter. Grand Aunt shakes her head at yet another illogical foreign habit. "If we all stopped, no one would get anywhere." No matter. Grand Aunt feels most comfortable at home, cleaning the rooms and preparing meals. And when Cherry sits with her, Grand Aunt likes to tell stories. Her subject taboo is clear. Nothing about the war and its aftermath. "Bad memories," she says. "I'm too old to cry anymore." She prefers talking about her childhood in Nachang with Grandpère, her sons, and the fables she learned from Cherry's great-grandmother. Her favorite is the Trung sisters, legendary warriors from the first century who successfully drove out the Chinese, the first time anyway, to establish the country's independence. They are considered Vietnam's national mothers. "But they were married to the same man," Cherry says. Grand Aunt waves her hand dismissively. "All marriages have their problems." The Tale of Kyu, which Cherry tried to read in college, is another fable Grand Aunt likes to repeat. Though the main heroine is a prostitute, her despised social position is a tragedy she is forced into. Every story ends with a lesson. Everyone has choices taken away from them. Despair is pushed into our lives. We can only control how we recover. "Like you," Grand Aunt says carefully, as they assemble salad rolls for dinner. "You look so healthy and strong now. Your parents must be proud." So Lum has told her about the accident. This shouldn't surprise Cherry, although she suddenly feels self-conscious, wondering how much Grand Aunt knows. "Lum had me call every day while you were in the hospital," Grand Aunt says, dipping another sheet of rice paper into a bowl of water. "I tried to get him on the phone, but he didn't want to speak to your parents." "My parents don't know the whole story," Cherry says. "They still can't understand." "Have you tried making them understand?" Grand Aunt asks. Cherry falters briefly under the woman's firm gaze. "Yes." "It doesn't matter," Grand Aunt says, returning to her rolls. "He is fine now. I don't have to tell you. You can see for yourself. We have been good for your brother." "They did ask him to come back," Cherry says. He has a life here now, Granite reminds her. But it's not home, Cherry says, struggling to control her impatience. It's not America. Instead of becoming angry, as Cherry expects, Granite only smiles faintly, bemused. After spreading the mint, basil, bean sprouts, and shrimp together, she wraps and tucks it into a perfectly shaped roll. You know who you sound like, Granite says? Your grandfather, when he tried to convince Bak Chan and me to leave Vietnam. Cherry peers down at the saturated rice paper between her fingers. Grandpa wanted you to escape too? He'd already bought our seats, Grandaunt says. He bothered us until the night they left. But the point is, he was wrong. I'm glad we stayed. How could I have left my two boys before they were properly buried? And now we have your brother. Not everyone was fated to leave. Maybe, Cherry says, distracted. It doesn't matter what she thinks, this relative she hardly knows. Instead, Cherry imagines these two seats on the boat, empty, wasted. They mold the salad rolls in silence, allowing the chorus of children's chatter and motorbike engines from the alley to fill the kitchen. So that scene sets up the mystery of the novel in that Cherry doesn't understand why there are two empty seats, because a longstanding grudge between the two main families in the novel, the Trungs and the Vos, is that the Trungs were supposed to bring the Vo family over with them out of the country. And at the last minute, the Trungs claimed there were no more seats on the boat. So Cherry has just found out that there indeed were seats on the boat. And so part of her quest is to find out why her grandfather lied and understand why her maternal grandmother can't forgive the other family. So I'm going to read a second scene. There are several narrators throughout the book, so we've got different family members narrating it, and so in that way you get different accounts and different sides of the story of what happened. And the two other main narrators are her grandmothers. Grandmare, who you heard mentioned in the first section, and she's referred to as Hua in this section, and she's married to Grandpere, and they live in Paris, and they live in a three-story apartment building, and that's important because each family has a floor of an apartment, and so they're all close together, and Hua's very proud of this, and so this is her scene. Although Hua didn't work like her sons or volunteer at the community center like her husband, she kept herself busy and productive. In the morning, she made breakfast in her ground floor apartment. She prepared the children thermoses of crab meat soup and baguette sandwiches for lunch. I'm going to skip ahead, so that's why there's the strange transition. After the house was empty, Hua proceeded to clean each apartment. None of the family bothered to lock the doors inside the building anymore. Hua liked this part of the day, organizing her children and grandchildren's belongings, holding and dusting the items that mattered to them. She felt hopeful when she found a technical college brochure on Feng's dresser, and disappointment when she later emptied the crumpled paper out of the wastebasket. She knew when her granddaughter had tired of her coloring books and had moved on to reading chapter novels, or when her grandson, Zuan, outgrew his fear of murderers lurking on the fire escape and dismantled the barrier of pillows and stuffed animals along his bedroom windowsill. The only area Hua avoided was Hung's desk in the spare room. He specifically requested she not come near it when he was away from the apartment. He had been the same way about his study in their house in Na Trang, which irritated Hua. The entire study, which was a pleasant space, good windows with afternoon sun, would collect dust and he wouldn't care. Hung and Hua shared the spare room, half of it his office and the other half her knitting and prayer space. Though Hung hardly kept anything on the desktop, Hua couldn't help but linger over that corner of the room. The items of significance, his journals and letter correspondence, which he carried over on the boat and protected all those months in the refugee camp, lay secure in one of the three drawers on the right side. There was no padlock. Hua easily could have read all she pleased. But she knew that Hung would find out. It had happened once, early in their marriage. Hua did not wish ever to incur that level of wrath again. Still, she felt free to privately speculate about the journals and letters. She assumed they contained information about his business dealings, correspondence with the educated elite of Na Trang, scholars that included both French and Vietnamese women. It no longer bothered Hua that hung once kept mistresses. When she first learned of these poets and artists, she had been pregnant with Yen. Hung's older sister assured her that continuing to bear sons secured Hua's status as his only wife. Now, Hung was frankly too old and tired to indulge in such frivolous relations, but it irritated her that he kept such tangible evidence of his indiscretions. Sometimes she walked past the room and saw him reading those letters. While she was busy cooking and cleaning for their family, he was reminiscing about his shameful past. Hua truly didn't want to know any more of Hung's thoughts. She knew enough of his stubbornness, his denigrating opinions, and to read them in print would give them more significance than they deserved. He never hid his disappointment concerning the kind of wife she turned out to be. "If my father only knew before he died," Hung would say to her on difficult days, "he would have driven that matchmaker out of Nachang." Hua hardly left the house, and when she did, she preferred remaining either in the 5th or 13th arrondissement, where other Chinese and Vietnamese immigrants frequented. She remembered when Yen took the family to the Eiffel Tower for the first time. On the balcony, a small blonde boy, cheeks sticky with chocolate ice cream, stared, open-mouthed, at Hua. When Hua grinned at the child, she was only trying to be nice, his face crumpled and he burst into tears. After Yen exchanged words, apologies, and much laughter with the boy's father, he finally explained the confusion to his mother. "He was scared of your teeth," Yen said. "He's never seen a woman with black teeth before." Just a little boy. He did not know and probably would not care how many hours Hua's mother spent soaking those teeth with red sticklack and betel nuts so they would look that dark. It was fashionable back then to have lacquered teeth, the darkest in all of Vietnam, her mother would proudly say. With a lacquered smile, suitors knew you came from a respectable family. During their matchmaking ceremony, Hung complimented her teeth, one of the few compliments he ever gave her. Since the Eiffel Tower, Hua tried to smile as little as possible. When her children weren't around to help, and she was forced to speak with native Parisians, she kept her head low, lips close together. No one had cried or laughed at her since. So that is Hua. And so the third section I'm going to read to you is from Kim Lee's point of view. And Kim Lee is Cherry's maternal grandmother, who lives in Orange County with Cherry. And so let me find that section right here. And just a brief background on this scene. Kim Lee likes to tell everyone who will listen that she has high blood pressure, and she has it because of her family, and they stress her out. But she also tells anyone and everyone this to gain their sympathy. So she has recently returned from the pharmacy where she got a new medication. And at the end of the previous scene, she is alone in her room, and she opens the prescription bottle, and she throws the pills under her bed. And this scene kind of explains why. Whenever the doctors or her grandchildren would bring up the potential consequences of high blood pressure, she had to laugh. How could they guarantee that if she took this yellow pill in the morning and that blue pill at night, that her quality of life would increase by 15%? Unlike playing the lottery, which was all gain and tiny loss, a person's survival could not be determined by odds. If bad things were going to happen, they would happen. The pirates did not care if your boat had a 65% chance to reach Malaysia unscathed. They would threaten and pillage you anyway. There were nearly 40 people on their fishing junk. And though Kim Lee had complained that their family had been shoved into the undesirable middle section with no quick access to pee or vomit off the side of the boat, she realized when the Thai pirates appeared how fortunate they were to be protected by so many bodies. Everyone knew who they were, what they wanted, when they saw the boat creeping up the horizon hours earlier. There were only six of them. Six Thai pirates versus 40 Vietnamese refugees. Logic dictated that the Vietnamese could simply overpower six thieves whose only weapons were dull fishing knives and rusty razor blades. Yet, so many of her boat companions threw over their valuables, hysterically weeping for mercy. Their cowardice incensed Kim Lee. The pirates hadn't even bothered to jump onto their junk. sluggishly circling the boat and gathering their unearned spoils like monks collecting donations at temple. This was the laziest pirate attack Kim Lee could imagine. Odds had nothing to do with the volume and clarity of her scream. When the pirates drew near enough that she could see the moles on their faces and smell the stench of their ragged clothes, she reached her mouth up to the sky, and with all the breath in her lungs, she wailed and wailed and wailed. Kim Lee wasn't even sure what she was saying, if words uttered from her throat or nonsensical guttural moans. But when she felt her son Viet grab her face, press his forehead against hers, she was finally calm enough to look around the boat, Kim Lee realized that it had worked. The pirates had left. The rest of the refugees stared at her. Frightened or impressed, she wasn't sure. They said nothing for hours. They simply listened to the waves, dreading the appearance of another boat, but armed with the security of Kim Lee's shattering, powerful siren. Later, the other passengers would say the pirates were too lethargic to bother jumping on the boat to slash Kim Lee's throat. They'd gotten what they wanted and had left. Kim Lee felt these ungrateful dissenters had missed the point. If someone were going to take something from her, she wouldn't allow it to happen quietly. Years later, her children would still have to wake her from these screams. The pressure of Viet's or another child's hands around her shoulders, the soggy texture of the sweat and tear-stained sheets, the warmth of the bed, these sensations returned her to America. She was not on a boat. She was not falling into an ocean. There was no need to shout. Thanks. So those are three scenes, and if you have any questions about the book or anything else, I'd be happy to take them. Oh, did my parents tell and share stories with me? Yes, bits and pieces, very fragmented, and they got more detailed and facts were changed as I got older. So things that became G-rated, PG-rated, R-rated, and clearly they also had a perspective on things. They can't even agree on stories, on how they met, or the way they met in the Philippines and then they met again here. And I thought that was weird. What happened in the years in between? And so a long time I didn't know that. So that kind of helped shape a little bit of the book, because their stories were so interrupted in a way and so clearly designed to have an effect on us. Like, we suffered so much in Vietnam, we went through all this, so you better get straight A's. You know, so you better work really hard, because we sacrificed a lot to take good care of you, and there's a lot of people who don't have what you have, and you're incredibly lucky. And so that was the framework of a lot of my mother's narratives of, I'm going to tell you this story because it's going to teach you this lesson. And so I think all the different voices in the book, and there's also letters between each chapter between family members, that kind of serves also to show how the stories changed. Like for Cherry, her mission, and maybe a little bit of mine when I was younger, was I need to know all these stories. I need to know what happened to my family and how they all came here. And I think now at this point, where I'm at now and I have my own kids, I realize I'm never going to learn all their stories. And I'm never actually probably know the accurate stories, because they all have their own versions. And they're all entitled, in a way, to keep the stories to themselves. Like, Cherry's on this mission. I have to know the truth. And that's where Cherry and I differ a little bit, because I know the truth is very subjective, and it's not really going to make everything better the way she thinks it's going to. I really worried about that, too. Like, I had certain characters in here, and I hoped relatives wouldn't see themselves in there. And I think people have very specific visions of themselves. And so I'll have my relatives say, wow, that character was a bastard, and they'll have no idea, like, who it was inspired by. And it really, this really is fiction. And so, I mean, as a child, I think I thought more black and white about my relatives. Like, I had this idea that I had a cousin who was mean, or I had an uncle who was mean. And now that I'm an adult, they're not mean. You know, it was just, we were caught up in a lot of different family tensions of, you know, our parents arguing with a certain uncle and aunt, and suddenly, they were the villains. But they weren't really villains. They were having issues with each other, and so the gray area emerges when you can see both sides. So no, they weren't nervous, and I think my mom actually deliberately tells me stories so that I will include them. I remember I wrote this op-ed about the 30th anniversary or the 25th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. And I asked my mom about her experience about it, and I could tell when the story suddenly turned into her commentary and her painting herself in a lovely, lovely light. And so that's when I dropped the pen and I was just listening to my mom. But yeah. Mm-hmm. So my parents actually were here before the fall of Saigon. So they were here in the early 70s, in 1972. And I had actually several aunts and uncles who were here earlier to studying. My mother got a master's in social work in Paducah, Kentucky. I don't know why, what she was doing and why she found that program. And so she was here. And then people started migrating either officially, legally, and left on planes. A few left on the day of the fall of Saigon, and a few escaped by boat in the 80s. And the last to arrive, I would say, was in 1988. My grandparents came in 1985. I just found this out in Portland a few days ago, double-checking my facts. So it was. It's this long. So they all have different stories about the way they came here, which I always found really interesting. And there's also a huge age gap. My grandfather had two wives. His first wife died, and my dad was one of the older sets of children. But the age difference between the oldest child and the youngest is, 20 years. So you would have the eldest Becca, who is my eldest aunt, had children who were older than my grandfather's youngest child, and so it created a lot of confusion, and everyone just said, just call them aunt or uncle, and it'll be fine. Have any of them gone back to Vietnam? Yes. Although this is a little controversial. Most of the younger kids go back. I have a cousin who goes back every year to study music. So it's very baffling to the older generation who really avoided it, because I grew up in the 80s when Vietnam was described to me as a hell on earth that we couldn't return to because they'll kill us, because the communists were killers. They were villains. They were the bad guys. And so one of the narratives in here is the reason why Lem is sent back, there was like this old wives' tale of if you're not good, if you don't appreciate all the opportunities you have in America, we'll just send you back to Vietnam. And then that happens literally to Lum. That happened to a classmate of mine in high school. She was actually literally sent back to Vietnam to live with relatives because the parents thought she was a little out of control. And I thought that was fascinating. I think that was kind of one of the seeds to me writing this book. She came back, but I love the idea of Lum staying there. Because I have a lot of classmates and I have a lot of friends and relatives who've gone back and are fine with it. But it serves as a huge generational conflict of dealing again with the communists, of moving past the war, of moving past the political animosity, which created a lot of suffering. I don't blame my parents' generation at all for the grudges they have, and because they lost a lot. I lost an uncle from the war, from a communist sniper. My dad will always recall the story to me. So a lot of it's buried, really deeply within them. So my mom wanted to take me back to Vietnam because she knew I was a writer and it was important for me to go back, and she had pushed my father to take us back. And the first trip we had planned was, I think, in 99 or something. And then my dad had a nightmare that night and said, we can't go. And so the trip was canceled. And then it was 2003 when We Should Never Meet was going to come out. And my mom said, we really have to take her back. She has to go back and see what it's like. And my dad agreed. And so we went back for 3 weeks, 2.5 to 3 weeks. And it was an odd thing to go back. I think a lot of people usually have relatives to go back to. We didn't. All of our relatives had left. And so we went back and I think it was odd for my parents to go back to their home country as tourists, staying in hotels and seeing things from a tourist perspective, and having things pushed on them that they weren't interested in. Like they had tour guides who would say, we'll take you to all these pagodas and we'll take you to all these temples. And my parents are like, we just want to like sit in a restaurant and go to sleep. And and just walk around. And that kind of showed how Vietnam was changing a lot for them, that there were all these tourist sites that my parents were like, that's just a rundown temple. No one went there. And now it's, because Vietnam is like a really popular tourist attraction, like they've elevated a lot of these places that my parents' generation didn't really consider valuable. But, yes. So basically they stain the teeth. So the question is about the women with the black teeth in Vietnam. And yes, a lot of women will chew the betel nuts as kind of just this snack. But also what happened was that they would purposely stain the teeth so that they were all black, all uniformly black, as a cosmetic kind of appeal. And that's what my grandmothers did. I think I always started off thinking I was a fiction writer. And it's only recently I've started writing some memoir pieces and really loving it. But I think fiction protected me to make the characters who I needed them to be, and make decisions that they needed to make. Like, there's a lot more drama and tragedy in this book, I think, although my family has their own traumatic histories. That's not in here. Like, it's very much fictionalized. All the major betrayals, all the major turning points in this book are fictionalized, although I think a lot of emotional things feel authentic to me. So what happened in terms of my family's place in this book, I think they were all starting points. Like, I would look at my grandparents, or I would look at my parents, or my aunts and uncles, and think about their migration stories to come here, and the things they left behind in Vietnam to come here, or to go to France, and the tensions that still existed between each other. And so those were starting points for me at the beginning of the book. And from there, they did what I needed them to do as a fiction writer. I had to make them make bad decisions and do things against each other that my family never did against each other. And so for me, fictionalizing is very liberating so that they can do all the things they needed to. And I think back when I first started this book, which was 8 years ago, I didn't think I had lived enough or knew enough to write a memoir. And honestly, those are their stories. I would feel very worried about taking something from them at this point without knowing enough about what they've gone through. And of course, if I even tried to write it, they would probably say, you got it wrong. You know, you didn't get that right, because everyone has their own version of what has happened in the past. I'll listen to some of my uncles talk about things, and they're so passionate about something, even if I know factually that they are wrong. With my previous book, Operation Babylift, We Should Never Meet, takes this historical event of Operation Babylift, which is the evacuation of all these orphans to America. And I was talking to my uncle about this, and he said, well, you know that the communists shot down one of the planes, right? Didn't happen. That's not true. But I can't say to my uncle that's not true, because in his heart, that's what he believes happened. Like, he in his head, the communists were the ones in charge. What happened was there was a malfunction in the plane, and that's what brought this plane of the children and caretakers down, which was a tragedy in Operation Babylift. But those were some of the instances of realizing that a lot of what my family knows and still believes in, like, those are their truths. Not necessarily my truth yet. So yes. Are my university students curious about my life? I think it is a little bit too far in the past. I think if it was a specific class, I teach a lot of creative writing classes where the students are really, really interested in their own stories and writing their own stories, and it's my job as their teacher to facilitate them to write their stories. Although I did teach at Washington State, I taught a Southeast Asian American literature course, which was really fun. And so there was a little bit of curiosity about what happened. But I'm honestly not sure what this generation knows about Vietnam, if at all, besides the fact that it's a great backpacking country to go to go touring in the summer, which it's really become like that's the new, because it's cheap to go to. But what's interesting is when I go to and speak at classes like Vietnamese American literature course classes, and I'll visit and they treat it very much as an artifact now, like Vietnam War, and it is, well I did too, you know, as a youth I thought the Vietnam War was this black and white thing, that you saw in history books. And for them, I think it's hard to understand. And so curious, I hope they are. Like, that's my favorite word for a student, to be curious, to continue to be curious, because that will encourage them to learn all their lives. I teach in an art school where I have very inspired students who are curious about their own crafts. But in terms of history, I hope that develops. They continue to be curious about that. Right. So the question is, what is my process? Because a lot of writers have different processes. So this book had different processes of where it was going. Like I said in the beginning, it started off as a bunch of different short stories and had different characters, and they were failed short stories, and one was a failed novella. Not failed, just incomplete. They didn't see the light of day. And I loved little bits of them, and so I put them together, and I thought, okay, what's going to set this story off? And so I spent a lot of time gestating, thinking about how I would tell this family story. And so I started off with this idea of this young woman, Cherry, going back to Vietnam to find her older brother, realizing that there was so much of her family history she didn't know about, and she had to find out for herself, because she doesn't know why her family is so disjointed and fractured, and why they won't forgive each other for things that they can't even talk about anymore. And when that happened, I realized I couldn't tell the story just from Cherry's perspective. So then I knew, okay, I have to have multiple narrators, multiple perspectives in the book. How many am I going to have? And this, for me, like, is a very fun thing to do. I love multiple narrations, multiple character perspectives, because it's more fun to get into the heads of other people. Like, if, I don't know if you could tell while I was reading, like, I love Kim Lee, so I love reading her sections, because she was the character who did whatever she wanted, said whatever she wanted, and as a writer, that's so liberating to be able to have a character just do what she wants. And she's so convinced about it, even when she's wrong. She's just really convinced, anyway, of what she believes in. And I love that about her. And other characters, like Cherry, she's so unsure of herself. I really struggled with her perspective. And I really struggled with her voice, of trying to make it as compelling as some of the other characters' voices. And then later my editor said, the reason why Cherry's voice is so hard is because she carries the book. Like, it's on her shoulders to take us through the narration, while the other characters can just pop in and show off their flashy stuff and then pop out. And so then I realized, okay, so if I set the first chapter in, I think it's 2001, then I'm going to flash back, and then we're going to go back to the 70s and 80s and 90s and find out what happened to this family. And so from then, I didn't want it to be too confusing, but then that's when I knew, and that's when I could plot it out. And so I think I had a rough idea. But then things would happen. I mean, it took me 8 years to write the book, and I think it's because I came to different breakthroughs about, like, what had to happen in the book. Like, I actually didn't even know what the answer was in terms of why grandpère didn't have enough seats on the boat. It didn't occur to me until year four of the book. And it came to me, I remember I was in a tea shop writing, and I thought, this is it. This is why. And it was this wonderful breakthrough, and it's really great thing to happen as a writer, for that to happen naturally, you know, instead of it being just manufactured, like, this is why, the whole time, this is the answer to the mystery. For me, it was something that was creeping through the stories. Like, the characters, in a way, knew it, and the way I was writing toward it, like, this is why grandpère was hiding this mystery, this fact. And then towards the end of the book, like, other character voices came to me. But it slowly kind of crept on me, the process, and it changed as I kind of grew as a writer, and grew. Like, I started the book as a daughter, I think. I didn't have kids. I wasn't married. And then I had all these life changes happen to me, and I think it helped the novel. It helped me understand Cherry's mom. It helped me understand the grandmothers. It helped me understand the older generation's perspective. And in a way, understand how naive Cherry could be sometimes about the way she goes about trying to find out things about her family. She's very young in this book. She ends it when she's 22, and I am 34 now. I'm 34. And I have to remember how old I am. And I'm sure when I'm 44, I'm going to feel the same way. Oh, Amy, when you were 34 and you wrote that, like, what did you know? You didn't know anything. And that's what happens, I think. Your history kind of grows with you. So the process is very organic for me. I'll take it where it needs to go and outline as necessary, and that helps me control it, but then it goes out of control again. So I have two projects, I think. One I was working on at Hedgebrook with some sisters here. Hedgebrook is this wonderful writing residency up in Whidbey Island, where I got a lot of writing done when I was 7.5 months pregnant. I have a 2-month-old. So that's what I'm doing right now, taking care of him. He's like at the Renaissance Hotel, and I hope he's okay. So I'm working on 3 novellas. And I wrote the first one while I was at Hedgebrook, a draft, a very messy, terrible first draft, which I haven't even looked at again. And then I'm thinking about actually writing a memoir, which is funny, because people were just like, well, is this it? And it really isn't. It's very close to my heart, because a lot of the characters were inspired by just my family's existence. But I'm thinking about writing a memoir of my father, who he is 75 years old, and he has Alzheimer's. And I had started writing essays about him and realizing, like, these were the things that were really important to me to write right now. And so I kind of put the novellas aside and thought, like, I'll write these as far as they go. But my father's story became really compelling to me, all his memories. And he's actually moving up to the Bay Area to live closer to us so that we could help take care of him. And so I think I don't want his stories to go away. And he has them all right now. Like, he has all his stories because his long-term memory is still crystal clear. And I want my children to have that. Like, I want them to know what a cool dad he was to me, like what a cool man he was. And I don't want them to forget that. So I think those are the two projects. Okay, the question is about my creative writing classes. What kind of assignments I give to ignite their imagination? Well, it depends on the class. If it's a beginning class, then I do a lot of intro prompts and exercises just to get them writing on the page, to write as much as possible. And that's really, for the first year classes, first and second year creative writing classes, you just want them to produce as much as possible, write as much as possible. And then year 3 and 4, you want them to pull back. Because then you realize, okay, you're writing too much. Now look back at your work and let's look at revision and let's look at editing and let's look at what you're trying to say. A lot of them already have a voice. You realize, like, everyone has a story to write. I remember hearing from a colleague of mine who's a nonfiction writer, everyone has at least one great story in them. And one incredible story within them to write. And she felt it was her job, her responsibility as a creative writing teacher to bring that story out. In fiction, there can be more possibilities to write more. So I've never found it a problem to get undergraduates or even graduates to write. Often, if they're in the class, they're inspired. Like, they already have it in them. Like, it's the same thing that I had when I was a little girl, and I wrote short stories on, you know, the little notebooks that my mom brought home from work and would give to me. And I would just write everything I could, write every story, because I loved narratives. And I think if you're someone who loves narratives, you're in a creative writing class because you're ready to tell stories. If you don't have anything to write, you probably don't need to. Like, why would you go through that pain? Why would you go through that anxiety of trying to write something when you can go have fun? I think a lot of my students, like, they write because they have to. They have a story within them, and they love writing that much that they will sacrifice a lot. And those sacrifices include, like, sometimes a living wage, you know, job security, you know, a stable life, because they love writing so much. Mm-hmm. I have a favorite book. Favorite novel, God. A book that really inspired me to write was probably Dog Eaters by Jessica Hagedorn, who did the multiple narrative, but her writing was so charismatic. Like, it taught me when I was an undergraduate, like, this is what good writing can do. It can make you this excited, it can make you, you know, it could really, literally, you can turn the pages. And so I love that book. And that book just did such a great job in terms of creating such a vast array of characters whose voices were so clear and just jumped off the page to you. And also tell a story about the Filipino history that I thought was really interesting. And she did it in a way that was so kind of non, you know, preachy at all. It was a beautiful, entertaining, intelligent read. And so I would say that is my favorite novel. Thank you so much for coming out.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.